against their governments and said no. Whether they were members of the peace movement, feminists, or black activists, they just said, we won't stand it anymore. What's happened in the last 20 years? Hans, it's very interesting to read your book, 1968, and find that it's like reading history. It's all such a long time ago, and I can't now see what directly has come out of any of those student revolts.
Oh, well, no, the book is very much meant not as history, not as, certainly not as a nostalgia exercise, but as a manifest almost. It's being directed at people who are 20 or, and up now.
Oh, I appreciate that that's what you intend, but I'm rather appalled to realise that seeds were sown and were well watered then, but they seem to be just sort of trampled down at the wayside.
No, I think they're little shoots that are appearing here and there, and in fact, our large trees are growing, but ignored by the media, which means that they don't exist for all practical purposes. But they are there, and they will be seen again. I have a strong feeling now, not today, I mean, but over the last month even, the pendulum does seem to go back very much. I think a lot of people will have reported on that in various ways.
We'll find out over the next hour what happened in 68 and where you say those large trees and those small seedlings are growing. But first, we would like to hear your first choice of music. What's that?
The first choice. It's Guantanamera, which is a poem of José Martillo. It's really a literary rather than a musical interest of mine in the first place, but it's a beautiful song. And it says, my destiny is tied in with the power of the world.
Hans Koning writes of in 1968. Remind us what the first piece of open resistance was, when people knew there was a revolution in the air.
Well, you'd have to go back a bit further, of course. In my own case, which is a case I know of many, it's a matter of, it's a civil defense protest, which started in in my case, 61. New York City used to have a monthly test of the air raid alarms, and once a year everybody had to take shelter between quotes, because obviously it was a fraud to stand under a staircase in an atomic bomb attack. It's not a very serious proposition. So a number of people decided to stand in Union Square in New York and refused to do this, to expose this as a fraud, and we were all properly arrested, which was an important thing for many people. It was sort of a political baptism in a way.
What happened to you after your arrest?
Oh, nothing interesting, quote unquote. I mean, nobody was beaten up, or we were all, you were booked and you wait around for hours and then you were bailed out. I mean, for a thing like that, I forgot what the charge is, disorderly conduct or something like that.
And how did the public and the press take it? Did they think that you were a very small group of loonies, or did they spot the fact that this was a serious protest?
No, it was of course, what is the basis of a thing like that? It's public theater, basically, you know, and it's a way to get into the newspaper, into the news, which you have to do, and this kind of thing. This was taken seriously. There were, I don't remember whom, but there were some sort of, quote, celebrities, unquote. And presently, the whole system changed. They also had at that time in Lexington Avenue in New York, they had a ghoulish sort of exhibit. It was a civil defense shop where you sort of saw a happy American family sitting between their bunk beds, drinking canned water, playing games, supposedly happily sitting out in atomic war. All that was we succeeded in ending all that. So the alarms and the exercises, it all stopped. They decided that the public that atomic war could not be made palatable that way. So the government chose the other way. They didn't disarm, but the whole thing was swept under the rug. The whole thing was abolished. Until now, of course, Star Wars is another way of trying to make people, quote, live with the idea of atomic war.
I don't know whether you saw a film called Atomic Cafe, but that really brought home to me the nonsense of some of the propaganda that was put out at the time. It was strung together some newsreels and some of the advertisements, the propaganda that the American government put out to tell people, you know, as long as you hide under a desk as a child, you'll be absolutely fine when the bomb goes off.
Well, there's a man in Washington, I can't think of his name, thank heaven, one of Reagan's assistant secretaries, where he said all you need is a door and a spade, and you can make your own shelter, and it's all fine. I mean, this was an official government statement not long ago.
But by the time it came to 68 and the revolts then, people were actually arguing with their government against a war that was going on rather than one that was potential for the future.
Oh, of course, this was the first thing, the atomic war. The next thing to be very brief about was, of course, civil rights, the Mississippi summer, all that. That was mid-60s. And then from 67 on, the main thing, the overriding thing which dominated our lives and which set the target for the movement was, of course, the Vietnam War and America being at war with Vietnam as we saw it and as the Pentagon Papers later confirmed that was the reality rather than America defending a democratic government against an invasion from the North.
But for so many people, not a popular thing to do to resist the draft because you were just accused, or those were just accused of being cowards. If you are a country at war and you're sending your boys off to be killed, you have to say it's a just war.
Well, the peace movement as such embraced much more than draft resistance. It was just a try to expose the incredible sea of lies which were told. I mean, I don't have to say any qualification here. It's on the record now that there were all lies. The draft movement as such took off very slowly, indeed precisely because people in the West, it's so bred into our bones that soldierly virtues and that you defend your country and that you're a coward if you don't. And I had a good platform I'm a veteran of World War II, which I only say because I felt it gave me some certain right to speak. What happened in my case was, and most of the movement people I knew, we were beyond draft age. And as you know, we started something called Resist, which was set up in 67 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the idea was, under American law, refusing to be drafted is punishable by $10,000 fine or 5 years in jail. And we said we can't sit here behind our comfortable desks or even behind uncomfortable desks and tell people what to do and just keep ourselves scot-free. Now, it so happened that suggesting to other people not to be drafted, advocating this is punishable in the same way. So Resist was set up. We issued a call to resist the legitimate authority, and we that way we put ourselves on the line with the draft resistors of 18, 19 and 20. And amazingly, 68, which is really the beginning of awareness among the larger public, within something like 8 weeks, 20,000 people had signed this call. In other words, 20,000 people, ordinary people, nice people in dresses and suits, not wild-haired hippies or anything like that, signed away potentially 5 years of their lives. Because if the government had won their first case and decided to pursue this, all those people could have been locked up for 5 years. But the government did, if you remember. Well, you're too young to remember, but anyway, some people may remember. They arrested, indicted the five very prominent names. Dr. Spock is the best known man, well known here too, of course, the baby doctor. And they came to trial on January 5, 1968. And three of them were convicted, two were acquitted. Then, of course, they appealed, and eventually the State Department, the Justice Department dropped the case because they realized that what they were doing was give us an enormous forum for statements. It was like public theater. So the government lost in that sense, and nobody was ever, after that, nobody was indicted for promoting draft resistance. But very many young people were indicted for refusing to be drafted, and very many people went to jail. That's not always known. I mean, people got very large jail sentences and very incredibly brave about it. And I mean, I know young boys, friends who refused to be bailed out, who didn't want to participate in any way, and the man went to jail for 4 or 5 years.
Hans Koning is reminding us of 1968, On the Night is Young. On the Night is Young, Hans Koning is my guest. We are talking about his book about 1968, but alongside that goes a fascinating personal biography. You mentioned the fact that you had come through the Second World War. Under what circumstances?
I was a high school boy, as you can hear, I guess, because I have this cadence, I'll never be able to share that. I'm from Holland. I was born in Amsterdam. I was in high school when the Germans marched in. I eventually got away about 2 years later. After Pearl Harbor, a line was set up, as you see in movies and what is that show? Anyway, you know, the underground stuff. I ended up in England and got into the British Army, and that was a couple of years. And as a matter of fact, that's why ever since I've been writing in English. It was really not something I sort of decided cold bloodedly. It just so happened that English became the language in which I think and dream. Although, of course, Holland is, Dutch is my original language. That was my first war of my life, Vietnam being the second war. I got out and went back to Holland, went to university for a brief spell. I was obviously too old, felt too old, too much had happened to sit in these benches again. And I went to Indonesia. I was invited to do a program there on arts for the radio. That took a year, and then it was a very chaotic year. It was interesting, but not so, rather a big mess. I got onto a freighter to the United States because I wanted to have traveled around the world, which is then sort of more of a big deal than it is now. And that is a long story too, because I got onto the Broad Without an American Visa, which was very hard to get in those days, and the McCarran Act was in full swing. And anyway, I somehow did manage to get it and landed in Los Angeles from this Dutch freighter, got into a streetcar. People were very surprised because no passengers have arrived there in a long time, and traveled through the U.S. and eventually sort of stayed more or less, went to Mexico, wrote a novel, and ended up living a large part of my life in the U.S., a large part of my life here, and also in Mexico and other places.
Wasn't there a time when you went to China and the U.S. was rather dubious about letting you back in?
Yeah, well, that's one of my scoops I got in 61. I wrote for the New Yorker as a reporter at large. I was in Cuba, actually, just after the Bay of Pigs, and sent a telegram to Mr. Shaw, the New Yorker editor, asking him if he wanted something about Cuba, because what was reported about Cuba and the U.S. at that time was absolutely appalling. Really appalling. And somehow I got his answer, and that's how I started writing for the New Yorker. And then shortly thereafter, I applied for a Chinese visa, because I was somehow in that category of people who wrote from difficult countries. And it took me 4 years of very much effort. It was really an enormous struggle. But in 1965, I got a Chinese visa, which made me the first person from the continental U.S. to get into China after the revolution. Edgar Snow had been there, of course, but he was a friend of Mao. He was a special, very special case. So that was a big deal, and I wrote about it for the New Yorker and wrote a book. I came out in Hong Kong, and China did not exist. Red China, as it was called, of course, did not exist on the books in the State Department. It was literally a white spot. So I could not ever touch. I could not ask for a return visa because I hadn't been in any recognizable place. So they said, where do you live? And I said, 4 East 95th Street. It was all very strange because I lived in New York, but I couldn't get back in. Anyway, after 6 weeks, there's still, as you know, still and again, always, there's a considerable respect for the media in the U.S. So journalists, in a sense, have it sort of easier than ordinary citizens. They've been in the Rotterdam consulate, of the U.S. consulate, for some German family by sitting crying their eyes out because they had spent the night in Yugoslavia. And foreigners who've spent one night in a communist country cannot come back into the U.S. That J. Edgar Hoover pushed that through because that was he thought that these people were immediately trapped into becoming spies. I don't know if that's still in the books, but that was until not so long ago. Anyway, with the help of Mr. Sean and the New Yorker and the State Department and whatever, 6 weeks later I was back in the U.S. And I had this group of having been in Red China. Of course, got an enormous hostility. I got onto television programs and people just screamed at me, "Get out of here, you dirty commie," because I did not report massacres and hunger, but it's amazingly orderly and organized country as now is, of course, recognized.
Can you explain this enormous American paranoia against communism?
Well, it goes back to the early 1900s when the Wobblies and the international various international workers' parties in the U.S. were shot and chased and hunted. Then after the First World War, there was this really paranoia, fear of the Reds. England is not that different, I must say. I mean, there are quite a number of instances where England, where if I may quote one, the BBC here went on calling North Vietnam the enemy after the NBC and CBS in New York had stopped doing that. I mean, in the nightly news during the last months of the Vietnam War, they said the enemy has this or that. Of course, first of all, there was no declared war. As you know, I mean, there was no legal war in the first place, and they were certainly not the enemy of the United Kingdom. I don't know why in America there's such a large middle America sort of redneck population. They have just been raised that the communists are identical to atheists, and I think it's a very large, basically a brainwashing operation by the powers that be, because communism, socialism, anything remotely connected with it threatens the American business. I think it's that simple. But of course, that's not the only explanation. There's also a lot of more subtle and emotional things involved in there too. Until 1940, America was very much open to immigrants who were refugees from fascist countries, German Jews and Italian anti-fascists and so on. Since 1945, America has become the haven of people who fled from communist regimes and communist countries, which as a result that there's an enormous increase in reactionary and right-wing sentiment, which I'm not judging here. I mean, you can understand somebody had I'm not denying that people may have fled under appalling circumstances, but they have influenced the national conscience. I mean, think of Miami, which is now an anti-Castro Cuban city virtually. I mean, what that does to the media and the general feeling of the population about the world. Now, only now, with Gorbachev out of some considerable counterforces, this does not go all across the board. I mean, there's a lot of very serious intellectuals in America and students and all sorts of people who think this is all absolute nonsense. That it's surprising to see how many Marxist professors there are at serious universities. But of course, the media, especially European papers or European reporters for television or radio who report from America, of course, take pleasure in honing in on these people, on the sort of the real sort of know nothing right wingers, because they're very picturesque in a way, if you don't have to be too near them. And people who sort of make moderate statements about left and right, they're not that interesting. So people here have actually a distorted image. America is not that quite rabid right wing as you get the feeling from reading British papers and seeing British television.
I wonder if America's got the right impression about us. That's an entirely separate conversation. Let's have your second choice of music.
The second choice of music is the Baccarat from Tales of Hoffmann, Offenbahn.
Why have you chosen this?
Well, it's sort of it's not a very highbrow choice, I realize, but I think it's the kind of music which has haunted me since I heard it first. I don't know when that was. And also, even more lowbrow, I have an association with Ludmila Tcharina, who was the woman in the gondola in the movie, if you remember that. And it was in those years extremely beautiful. Perhaps still is, for all I know.
You're so sweet.
Thank you.
Koning is my guest. Let's get back to 1968 now. We've gone rather a long way into your own life. But the events around the world, in particular in France, of course, remember the university uprising, some in England, but the majority in America, will have left their mark on the people who took part. But have they really changed the way that the system runs in any of those countries?
No. In one word. But there's a fund of knowledge and experience which is not exactly dormant, but dormant as far as the media perhaps are concerned and the public at large. But it's certainly there. There's a lot of movement activity going on. For one, Jerry Rubin, who became a stockbroker. There are 99 out of 100 of the people I know who are still, quote, movement people, unquote, except what we do now is not very spectacular, and it gets virtually no coverage because, of course, it so happens it's not now something people focus on, but that could very easily change. For instance, anti-apartheid in America was one of those issues which changed it, and like in the last time I got numbers, there were very many hundreds of arrests of students last year on various anti-apartheid demonstrations. It didn't get the coverage of the arrest of 68, but it's there. I mean, the idea that students are only interested at the moment in careers and tennis and their love life and their metabolism is just no longer true, if it ever was. I have a letter from a friend who described to me how NBC went to a university for the Today Show in order to show the public how the students had all become career-minded little gentlemen or ladies in Brooks Brothers suits. And the funny thing was that there was actually a major demonstration going on at the university as NBC showed up. And instead of televising the demonstration, they took care of shoving it out of the way because they had already their script, they had already had the argument was already on the books that the student world had completely changed back to what it was before. So the actual program which was shown ignored the demonstration which was going on as the program was being filmed. I mean, it sounds very ridiculous, but it's a marvelous illustration of what really goes on and what seems to be going on. Resist, I don't know if we went into that, the organization founded originally to put older people on the line who were no longer eligible for the draft, exists now and is mainly now a funding organization. At the darkest days of the war, which is sort of the Vietnam, the bombing winter, 71, 72, the Christmas bombing, which Nixon organized, we got something like $10,000 a month from people to promote anti-war activities. At the moment, it's about five times as much. So, checks from everybody, not from any specific origin. And this is simply used for an enormous variety of things like community clinics and all various one parent family efforts, rent strikes, all sorts of more or less progressive or sometimes radical policies. All this is there. It's simply at the moment it's not in the news because nothing has happened. I think it's, for instance, the Vietnam syndrome, so-called, but more properly speaking, the movement, the memory of the movement, has prevented the United States government up to now, and may prevent it in the future, to actually invade Nicaragua.
Do you expect to see the same sort of resistance, though, the same public uprising about what's going on in Central America as happened in Vietnam?
I don't only expect, I know absolutely, there's no doubt about it. There are hundreds of thousands of people on record as pledging themselves to nonviolent direct action, as pledging themselves to civil disobedience if this would happen. I mean, the Vietnam syndrome is like the guillotine syndrome in France. It kept the French kings of the 19th century very quiet. At the first sign of trouble, they ran away because they didn't want to share Louis XVI's fate. And I think in the same manner, Reagan did not want to share Nixon's fate or LBJ Johnson's fate and see his administration is integrated in public protest. And it's very much an accepted truth that that's so. There's been an enormous effort in the late 70s and early 80s of rewriting the history of the 60s, which is one of the reasons why a lot of people and myself have started writing about this. If you ask why did you wait 20 years, well, first of all, to get a sort of a perspective on the whole thing, but also because there was a rewriting operation in progress. It wasn't quite Orwellian, but it was not that different. I mean, we may think how marvelously democratic everything is, and freedom of the press and all that. But still, as everybody knows, there are large interests at stake in various things. There was a sort of a consensus that the 60s were being rewritten, even to the point of the myth of that the movement had sort of stabbed the Pentagon in the back. You know, Rambo, Sergeant Rambo, in this appalling movie of this appalling man whose name I don't want to. Bleeding Hearts and various unsavory characters had prevented the Pentagon from putting up a proper effort. Now, if I may quote one thing, the Pentagon dropped 100 times more bombs on North Vietnam than were dropped in World War II. So there was a considerable effort. All that leads me to explaining why a lot of books appearing now tell people what really happened. And for this book, I've talked to a number of old friends, for instance, Howard Zinn, who is a history professor in Boston, and he tells me that he's a very popular professor with his students. I don't think he's very popular with the faculty, because he's rather leftist, and they don't like that too much at Boston University. He tells them about the Vietnam War, and there is no Rambo reaction at all. People are appalled, and they say, how could we let this happen? And these are just ordinary students. So all this is rather encouraging from my point of view.
And at the same time, 20 years ago, there were black activists grabbing the headlines, and there were feminists insisting that the movement in general allow them all on the bandwagon, or wasn't it quite like that?
Well, I think feminism women's rights is really a one issue, of course, but it's not in my books, it's not a radical issue. It certainly isn't anymore. I mean, the women are a majority in the United States, as in most countries, and I think that the establishment and the powers that be have finally realized that it would just be inane and insane to pretend that they aren't. So to say that women have equal rights is not a radical statement. It's a radicalization of society to really make it work. Black rights is something completely different. I think black rights on paper now have been very well established in the U.S., but in New York, you see that the law which LBJ Johnson passed in my year, 1968, which proscribed discrimination in housing, that's 20 years ago, you can see that the effect of that law was 0.0, because if there is no non-discrimination housing, this ghettoization of America has gone ahead full-fledged. So that's a very different thing. I think that the candidacy of Jesse Jackson is incredibly important.
But the laws exist, and in America, of any country, is always one where there will be lawyers who will stand up and say, this law is being flouted, and we want the government to change its ways, and here is one example. And there are endless, I don't like to use the word token cases, but is what it would be, to just to test these laws and say, you must use them, you must get them into shape.
Well, Reagan has reduced federal housing to virtually zero in his now almost 8 years in office. So that was one thing which dried up a whole channel of non-discriminatory housing. America may basically be law-abiding, but property, of course, is sacred, and to tell a landlord what to do with his own property, that's a very tough proposition. There are a million different subtle ways of showing that a certain tenant is just not very desirable. Of course, there are inroads. It also depends where you are. There's no monolith. New Haven, for instance, in Connecticut, is one of the cities which has gone very far in non-discriminatory housing. But other places, it's very bad. It's largely, I think, just as racism in England always, in my idea, was sort of almost a social thing. It was really a matter of not matter of race, but sort of class, really. If you were a very elegant man, you could be black, and it was fine. In France, it's a matter of language. If you speak fluent French, you're accepted, no matter your skin. In America, of course, it's very much a matter of poverty and riches. A rich black man will certainly be able to buy a beautiful apartment, but the facts of the matter are that most of the poor are black, and most of the blacks are poor.
What's your next choice of music?
The next choice of music is, that's a very nice thing, and I don't want, I must say, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm a great music connoisseur. It's, I know the music in my head, and I had to look up what it was before I could tell you to ask you to play it. It's Salina's aria in Mozart's Don Giovanni.
Vidrai Paris, nostri
the soprano with a Philharmonia orchestra and chorus on LBC Radio. About 1968, we've concentrated mostly on America, but there were things going on in England.
Well, Chicago, America, Chicago, the 68, the Democratic Convention. I don't know how many people remember this or lived through it. That was a big deal. The whole world is watching. Humphrey was shouting, and indeed the whole world was watching. Humphrey was nominated against the sense of the nation, really. And Daley, the mayor of Chicago, had sent his troops out, and it was a police riot every night. It was an amazing spectacle. And that created the backlash of that, or the result of that was an enormous intensification of anti-war protest in Europe, specifically in London in October. I was here, and on behalf of Resist, I was handing out leaflets telling the people how many the bomb load on Vietnam, and I was standing on the corner of Grosvenor Square and whatever that street there is, and I think there's something like 100,000 demonstrators were in Grosvenor Square, if I remember rightly. There were a lot of those things. I may confuse one with the other, but it went into late at night when we were carrying torches, and the American embassy was really sort of looking like a fortress under siege. In fact, it has looked that way more or less to me anyway ever since. It looks a bit like a Gestapo headquarters in Paris with all these gates and things you can't park anymore. That was a big night. Nevertheless, 68 as such has never been the year in London which it was in America and most cities, in Paris, in Prague, in Bangkok, in Turin, in a lot of places, because the spirit of 68 went around the world, as you know. I have various theories which are perhaps not too interesting to air here about why it never hit England, but basically, of course, England was outside of that particular war. France was, and France had its own Vietnam syndrome, followed by an Algeria syndrome. The students of Turin were very much depressed and repressed. England had different problems. I remember on May 1, 68, The Black Dwarf came out. It was the first sort of really radical paper here, comparable to the underground newspapers of the U.S., like the Berkeley Bob and the New York Guardian. It didn't last very long. There was no particular specific issue the students could sort of sink their teeth into. There was a social democratic government here, a labor government. I think the big issue of class society and things that was not touched upon, and nothing very much happened except demonstration at the American embassy. Somehow America was the focus of protest. I remember a very incredible night of a protest meeting in Westminster City Hall, and the subject was George Jackson, the Black Panther, who was had been locked up for 8 years already in solitary in the U.S. in San Francisco, and here were something like 4,000 people were there protesting the fate of this one man 7,000 or 8,000 miles away. And it was nobody quite understood how this came about. There was a fireman standing next to me. He said he hadn't seen an audience like that since the Spanish Civil War. You had the feeling if somebody had taken over, you could have made these people march on Downing Street or set fire to the American embassy or whatever.
When you look back now, when you have been doing for your book 1968, have you come away with a feeling of optimism or pessimism?
Optimism. About politics, not particularly optimistic about sort of how we're going to survive down to the next, to the third and the fourth generation. I'm not as sanguine as some people are about the NLF treaty and things like that. I think the atomic threat is there, not quite as strongly as it was, but it's certainly very much there, and maybe a specific danger that we sort of think that this is all on the back now and everybody has wisened up. But I think that in the sense of politics, in the sense of a policy in which there's less of a two-nation policy, specifically in the U.S., I think there the pendulum has turned, and America is going to be way to the left of Mrs. Thatcher's England.
Thank you very much indeed for joining me this evening. What's your final piece of music?
The final piece of music is Desafinado, because it's played by Stan Getz and Charlie Bird, because it's sort of, to me, it's sort of the 60s, sort of a melancholy nostalgia 60s bit.
Well, before we hear that, I should say that Hans Koning's book, 1968, is published by Unwin Hyman. It costs $10.95. Thank you again for being with me.
Thank you.
Oh, no. he's usually with the people she has. She gets to do more talk than the person itself. And Dad was, I mean, she hardly got anything in. All the other people say yes. It's still less than an hour. We've only been playing on that clock. I looked at that clock. We've only been playing for 55 minutes.
30 minutes on each side.
No, because we're only 5 more minutes.